Rappin' with Reef Bum is sponsored by Champion Lighting and Supply, Polo Reef, and Fauna Marine.
Hey, hey, what's happening, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of Rappin' with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Burkelhammer. So today I welcome Dr. Greg Berard to the show. Greg is a marine biologist and the head of the marine biology program at Des Moines, Iowa Public Schools. What's going on there, Greg? We got some Wi-Fi issues on your end there, huh?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm going to blame it on the storms today. You know, you can always test, and then, of course, you know, it never works. So appreciate everyone's patience as we, you know, work through this.
Yeah, Greg might appear to be a little choppy, but I think we're gonna kind of slug this one out and hope the Wi-Fi on your end improves. It's it's like one of those little gremlin things going on there, and who knows, maybe it'll just kind of work its way out as we go on with the live stream. Worst case scenario is that Greg is going to freeze, his video is going to freeze, but we'll still be able to hear him. So if that happens, at least we've got his audio.
Let's hopefully it doesn't freeze on an awkward
just keep smiling
face position.
So if you freeze, you're going to freeze with a smile. So, all right, fingers crossed. Before we start chatting with Greg, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of this show. My sponsors are really important because they make this show possible with their support. And that means a lot since I want to continue bringing on awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. Champion Lighting and Supply is one sponsor besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online. Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polo Reef. I know Andrew Sandler's in the chat. What's happening there, Andrew? Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday in the new Polo podcast with Mike Sensky. We dive into the world of professional custom aquarium design and the story behind the journey. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. And my third sponsor tonight is Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums. From macro elements to trace elements and pollutants, you get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. I personally am now a certified Fauna Marine ICP Test Advisor, so if you want help interpreting your results, then select me. All right, with all that out of the way, Greg, man, how did you get into this whole field of marine biology? What got you started?
So the main thing that got me started was just watching TV as a kid and watching a documentary on squid. And that's what really got me interested. I wanted to study squid, wanted to study all cephalopods, octopus, nautilus, cuttlefish. And ever since the age of kind of 4 or 5, I wanted to be a marine biologist, even though, you know, I didn't really know what that meant at that age.
Yeah. I kind of had the same vision myself. I wanted to be a marine biologist. I just liked the way it sounded, and I liked playing with anything in the salt water in terms of kind of studying the habits and all that stuff. So, yeah, really cool.
Yeah, and I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, so how'd that happen?
I don't know. I was born in Houston, so pretty close to the ocean, you know, moved when I was about 6 months old, and somehow grew up in Phoenix wanting to be a marine biologist, which is just kind of an odd thing.
Yeah, really cool. So, now you're in another landlocked state, leading a whole nother group of folks in terms of learning about that whole field. What's your area of expertise? I mean, you mentioned some stuff there in terms of what kind of got you started there. Is that essentially your area of expertise in terms of, you know, marine biology areas of concentration?
Yeah. My research focus right now is this animal called the nautilus, and it's one of the shelled cephalopods. So they're related to octopus, squid, and cuttlefish. But my research is always focused kind of around those groups of organisms, whether it's caring for them in aquariums or doing research projects on them or doing field research throughout the Pacific. It's always kind of focused on those cephalopods. And, you know, in the last 15 years, I've added this kind of education component into it, which brought me here to Iowa to experience Midwest storms and tornadoes and all the fun weather.
I see you got one of your students in the chat here, Jason Grandstall. That's my teacher, double exclamation point.
Awesome. I was hoping some of them would join
in. Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, you know, so if the students are watching, you know, Jason, certainly drop some questions in the chat or some comments, whatever. You know, I'm sure you've asked Greg plenty of questions over your time in the program, but really cool. So, all right, we kind of touched on this, but Iowa is not near an ocean. How did this high school become so highly regarded across the country and even internationally, you know, as like a premier educational institution for marine biology and aquarium science?
Yeah, I think it weirdly enough, you know, it goes back to the students, I think, and just giving them an opportunity. Our marine biology program here has been around for, I want to say, about 40 years.
Wow.
So I'm kind of on the tail end of it. The facility we're at now has been around for about 14 years, and this is my 10th year. And with myself and Kirk Embry, who's the aquarium science instructor, you know, what we try and do every day is just to give students a chance to, you know, breed a fish, redesign a tank, ask a research question, and provide the facilities, the resources, and the support of him and I to, you know, be able to screw up, mess up, learn something different, and then take a different approach to become successful eventually.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. How many students are in the program?
Between both of our classes, we have about 150 every single year.
And how big is the school overall, would you say?
So the school is about 2,500 total students enroll in it. And it's more of like a maybe like a modern career and tech school, if you think about that. So students come to there to, you know, take marine biology or fashion or robotics, you know, something that they want to do as a career.
Yeah, Kaylee Sharp, former student in the house here too.
Sweet. Hey, Kaylee.
So how many of these students, you know, end up going into the field of marine biology and aquarium science? I mean, is a large percentage of them kind of move on to study that in college and make a profession out of it?
I think if we, you know, track them from, you know, when they graduate, I think about 50% of the students go into the marine kind of field. You know, things obviously change in college. You know, you find new things that you like. But the cool thing is right now, since I've been here for 10 years, I'm starting to see some of our students work at aquariums and finish their PhDs and actually become, you know, not just students, but colleagues and eventually friends, which is just a weird kind of thing I never really thought about when I started this whole teaching thing.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. That's really pretty neat. All right, so let's, why don't you give us you provided me with a bunch of videos and pictures. So maybe walk us through the lab. I'm gonna start playing that video where you just kind of give us a broad view of all the lab and just kind of, Greg, take us through in terms of how many tanks are in the lab, the types of tanks, that sort of thing, equipment.
Yeah, definitely. Am I going to see it on my side?
We're at about a 23-second delay or something like that. So I'm showing the 1 minute video that you would send to me. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So what y'all are seeing is kind of the midpoint of our lab. We divide it up into aquarium science and marine biology. And so kind of on the left side, when the video goes through, those tanks are focused on breeding different fish. There's a whole lot of clownfish, but the stuff you can't see is the exciting news that I think aquarium science students are going to be able to share in the next year or two of breeding different fish, of raising different organisms in the lab. So, you know, they're moving from clownfish, which, you know, is inherently hard on itself, to lots of other different species and lots of other different ways, trying to mimic not just what research places are doing, but what aquariums are doing around the country to raise larval fish. And when we move over to the aquarium science side, or sorry, the marine biology side, what we're trying to do is to set up natural ecosystems. And so we want to learn about the wild to be able to conserve them and protect them. So our tanks range from things like tropical coral reefs to temperate kelp forests with lobsters. We have octopus, we have cuttlefish, and kind of one ecosystem dear to my heart is Gulf of Mexico, specifically the western coast, because I just don't think it gets any love. You know, a coral reef is very beautiful, pretty. An oyster reef isn't really beautiful and pretty in the same way. So we're trying to highlight that type of ecosystem as well, because oysters also play, you know, a huge role in the wild, and their decline is one of the reasons why we see, you know, issues along the coast in the Gulf of Mexico and the you know, eastern seaboard.
So I just played the octopus video you sent me. Those are known as escape artists, correct? Has it made its way out of the tank yet?
No, and we don't have a lock on the lid. We don't have weights on it. We have the water level a little lower in that tank, but I think with a lot of small octopus species, if you provide them with a good habitat, they're not going to need to escape. Oh. And that's something that we talk about with students is, you know, providing that good habitat. So, you know, they don't want to go anywhere.
So what is the key in terms of providing that, that good habitat? What do they like when you're keeping them in captivity?
Well, depending on the species, some of them may want to bury in the sand. Some of them may want multiple dens or multiple areas to kind of hide in, and definitely a lot of food. And when you're feeding them on the bottom of the tank, hopefully over time they become conditioned to that and just kind of hang out on that bottom as opposed to, you know, exploring the top. We do provide things like enrichment items to, you know, have the octopus kind of, you know, look at, taste with their suckers. And we provide all of those on the bottom of the tank to, again, kind of keep them close to the bottom.
Now, you told me before, you know, we were doing a Skype test the other day, and this was something that really was impressive to me, is that you basically told me that the students are really the ones that are taking care of these tanks, and that, you know, you're just kind of trying to guide them. Can you get a little bit more into that in terms of what these students are actually doing with all these tanks?
Yeah, I mean, the school year starts, you know, late August, and so we have about 130 brand new students. We have some students that come into the lab for a second or third year, but that first month is training on things like, you know, what is a Ken scraper, what is a doodle bug pad, like all of these different things. And it's an intense course to get everybody up to date in a month, because we want them to start changing the lab and to start doing different things to the lab to keep it progressing, so we don't, you know, look back 10 years from now and we're like, well, why haven't we done anything? And, you know, our first kind of test is Thanksgiving break. The students come in and they care for the lab. I'm not there. The other instructor's not there.
Wow.
And they not only have to care for the lab, but they have to work with each other and figure out how to make that teamwork work, how to kind of take not orders, but how to take direction from your peers and how to, you know, be observant and say, you know, and say when something's wrong. But obviously it's an intense process that never stops. I mean, you never stop learning about your tanks, but the first month our goal is to give them everything they need to succeed. And it's worked so far.
I mean, I guess you're always like a phone call away if there's a tank emergency, right?
Of course, yeah. And, you know, the good thing about our lab is we have drains. And, you know, if we have an issue and, you know, there's water flooding, the nice thing is that we can, you know, just have the students, like, take a breath and why is the water flooding? Like, let's let the water go on the floor, but let's, you know, lower your heart rate. Let's lower that adrenaline and start troubleshooting what went wrong. And usually it's because a student has their hand over an intake cover or something.
That's a great life lesson, because, you know, really it's tending to a saltwater aquarium, reef tank, what have you, can be stressful. And it takes a lot of patience. And it takes a special person to kind of like step back, and if there is something going on that's not very good and there's a problem, then you gotta, you know, I guess what I'm trying to make the point of is that it's going to teach students how to deal with other types of adversities in their life.
Yeah, because, you know, again, all of our students aren't going to go into this career, this field. So it's those things of, you know, getting through something hard, and, you know, my students may not like it, but I really want to set them up to fail, which sounds counterintuitive, but I just want them to, you know, we don't really learn anything until we fail. So it's trying to find good ways to support them through that, because you don't want, you know, anybody to fail over and over. You're going to lose confidence and lose momentum. But it's just a really unique facility to kind of do that, whether or not a student's going to be a nurse or wants to work at an aquarium one day.
And there are a lot of low points. There are a lot of failures when it comes to tending to fish tanks, for sure. And you learn those kind of hard lessons. I mean, I guess it just turns into a, you know, you chalk it up to experience. It's something that, you know, it happened and you move on, but you learn from it.
Exactly. You know, a broken tank sucks when you over tighten the bulkhead on it. And, you know, we talk about it. We all get a little upset and frustrated, but yeah, you got to move on in a more positive direction.
Jason Langer, what's up there, Jason, says, seeing the excitement and wonder in the eyes of young students when they see animals from the ocean is one of my favorite moments. When my son and I hatched and raised baby sharks at a school in Wisconsin, WI, is that Wisconsin?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I have a good shark story. So several years ago, we brought in a swell shark egg from the Minnesota Zoo, and we had it for a few months. You know, we kind of knew it was going to hatch every, you know, it could be any day. Winter break happened, and on Christmas Day, one of my students sent me a text and asked if I put a toy shark in with the shark egg. It's kind of like a gift, I guess. And it took me a couple seconds to think about it. And what she was looking at was the shark that had hatched. So it hatched on Christmas Day and still wasn't moving too much. But Jason bringing up that shark thing made me, you know, think of that moment for that student.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, yeah, they're basically experiencing everything in terms of the life cycles of the animals that they're taking care of, which is pretty awesome. So, all right, let me show a couple more of the tanks here and some of the pictures. You've got, explain to us this lobster tank.
Yeah, this is our, not just kind of lobster tank, but this is a good example of kind of ghost fishing. So when we talk about marine biology, we want to talk about conservation issues. And this particular lobster was sent to us from a restaurant in Boston because it's a unique color morph. It's more orange than red, and they didn't want to cook it. So they donated it to us. We had this kind of half broken lobster cage built, and it gives us a chance to talk about lobsters, but also talk about the impacts of ghost fishing.
So, I mean, what else besides the lobster is in that? Is that tank pretty much, is the only thing you can keep in a tank with a lobster?
We have an anemone in there, but yeah, that's the lobster tank. We have some artificial kelp, some other things, but it's, doesn't play well with others.
How many pounds is that lobster? Looks
pretty
big.
We haven't weighed it. It's a good size, maybe 8 or 9 pounds or so.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you guys were able to save it from somebody's dinner table. Okay, let's. Then there's another cool tank. This is a picture of a. I'm calling it like I see a blowfish, a boxfish in there. I see a I see Dory in there. This is like a display tank with a bunch of different types of fish. It looks like a fish only tank with some ceramic coral in there. Yep.
Yeah, this is our deadly and dangerous tank.
Deadly and dangerous. Okay.
It's one of our examples of a tank where we have some artificial corals. We don't have live corals in all of the tanks. And I think I failed to mention this tank is one of about 160 different tanks we have in the facility.
Wow.
You know, as small as 5 gallons to as big as 2,400 gallons. And so this tank gives us a chance to kind of work with fish only, as you mentioned, and not worry about kind of live corals in there. So recently we've added some lionfish to that tank, and we're going to add another eel to it soon. Just to kind of, you know, give that students the opportunity to work with those kind of like scary or dangerous animals and see that they're not so scary and dangerous.
It's a lot of work to do maintenance on all those tanks. So those students are really getting their hands wet, so to speak, huh?
Yeah, and our expectations are nothing less than an aquarium. We have days where we have tour ready days. We also give a lot of tours to folks that come in, and you know, I pick on them for a little spot on that tank of algae. Like, we got to get that spot because you know, the guests may not notice it. You know, most of us may not notice it, but to me, what that tells me is you're looking at the details, and you're probably going to catch that little white spot on that fish that's sick, so that we can treat it, observe it, do what we need to before it gets bad. And I'm sure sometimes my students on here, they probably don't like me too much because I am like
stickler.
Got to get it. Yeah, but when they get it, it's awesome, and you know, they know it's awesome.
How do you handle like algae issues, like say, you know, bacteria, or if you got hair algae and stuff like that? What's the approach there to tackle that kind of adversity?
Yeah, so depending on the system, and specifically in marine biology, we want to, you know, collect data on it and, you know, first look at what our water quality values are. You know, is something out of whack? Did we change something? Did we miss a water change? Did we add a new light? And talk about the scientific method in a different way than I think I grew up talking about the scientific method, because I was, you know, told you do this, 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 this. So we talk about it in a way where we're not just going over step one, step two, but, you know, depending on the system, maybe it's a water change or two, a lighter feeding. Maybe we needed to adjust the light. And I think just giving students those different variables that, you know, could cause an issue like that, gives them an opportunity to kind of just narrow it down. And we have some systems where, you know, for a year, we just couldn't get rid of the hair algae. And it was tough. We never really got down to the bottom of it until we got a brand new sump, a whole new filtration system, kind of focused on our feedings and got everything back in balance and back in harmony. And that also, you know, gives us a good example to talk about things going on in the wild, of algae blooms in the wild, and kind of correlate that to stuff happening right now in the ocean. So it's annoying to deal with, but you know, we always try and tie it back into the larger ocean as a whole.
How hard do you guys lean on testing in terms of hobby grade test kits, ICP testing, you know, for nutrients, calcium alkalinity, magnesium, that sort of thing?
We're kind of in between. We have some of the, we have looked into the ICP testing. We haven't done that yet because I don't think we're prepared enough to do what we would need to do after we get the results. So right now we're also trying to like balance the school day of students being in class for 90 minutes. And I want them to know water quality and to be able to do the tests, but how do we, you know, find that nice groove of not having to do a test every day? So we have some automatic systems that will, you know, tell us conductivity, pH on the system through an app. And the students get trained up on refractometers and such. And then we also have a Hawk spectrophotometer for some of the tests that we can do. So, you know, I really want students to be able to do kind of hobby level stuff, aquarium level stuff, mm-hmm. and research level stuff, and be able to know it all, so that when they leave here, you know, they can speak to all of those methods of water quality, because they're all a little different.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, and in terms of like general equipment, what do you guys, I saw it looked like, you know, obviously some protein skimmers, mechanical filtration.
Yeah, we have protein skimmers in every system. We were fortunate to add a couple UV sterilizers to two of our systems. Aside from that, it's filter socks and live rock bio balls.
Bio balls, and, interesting. Old school.
Yeah, so we're kind of shifting away from that with some of these new sumps we're bringing in. But even with bio balls, you know, it's talking to them about, you know, how do you really use these effectively? Because, you know, just putting them underwater in a sump is not really the most efficient way to use those. And, you know, how do you create a bio tower that gets that kind of trickle effect in our little setting? So a little bit of everything, but with the overall goal of, you know, shifting progress and making sure that we're at least showing some of the kind of most up-to-date things in the lab.
Yeah, you know, I've been in the reef keeping hobby for about probably over 30 years and what have you. And when I first got into it, it was all live rock, and you know, there was the bio ball component of it and that sort of thing. And You know, but now the last 15 years or whatever it is, people are starting tanks with dry rock, dead rock, and you know, there's a lot of issues that come along with that because it's a longer process in terms of building up that biological bed. But there are ways to get around it, so people, you know, have success using the dry rock. Me personally, I'm not so much success, but. Is that something that, you know, I mentioned bio balls in old school. Is that something your students and you are trying to kind of leaning on in that sense in terms of not utilizing more modern techniques like the dry rock thing?
Yeah, and really just for sake of yeah. time. If I really had it my way, I was trained using oyster shell. Huh. As biological filtration for cephalopods in an aquaculture setting. And, you know, if it can handle that amount of bio load that cuttlefish, squid, and octopus produce, I mean, it sucked cleaning it, but that's my old school way that I wish I could go back to, but it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do.
You mentioned cuttlefish. I want to show the cuttlefish video because I thought these were sea slugs when I looked at it. But then you're like, no, these are cuttlefish. I'm like, wow, those are cuttlefish, but they're incredibly colorful.
Yeah, these are the flamboyant cuttlefish. And this is part of our kind of larger plan to become kind of the center of cuttlefish and octopus breeding in the Midwest. Mm. And so to the left of that tank, we have a new culture system, which the goal is to bring eggs in from different cuttlefish and octopus species, raise them up, and complete that life cycle in-house so that we can not only, you know, have animals to display and learn about in the facility, but to donate to the industry and to aquariums and zoos that support us, you know, every single day of the year, you know, for years and years. And that's what we're just starting this year. And, you know, hopefully in the next year, we'll have some cool updates to share.
I was going
to
ask you, like, what have you learned about cuttlefish? Because I think I've only seen them once in person. And they're truly, my understanding is that they're one of the more intelligent, you know, organisms or animals that you could keep in a saltwater tank. They're just so intelligent, like an octopus. And they have, like, these personalities.
Yeah, we talk about personalities in class because if my students can prove that our fish have personalities, like, we're going to win a lot of money. My bias to that is, like, let's show the science, let's, you know, find the data. But cuttlefish certainly interact with their environment, like, very differently than other animals, just like octopus. And so, you know, you need to know the actual species to know, like, the cuttlefish that were in the video, you know, they like to live on the bottom. They have those really bright colors. They're going to be, you know, walking around on the bottom, whereas other cuttlefish like Sepia bandensis might want to perch more, and they might kind of want to live more vertical, kind of in the tank. So, you know, it's really knowing the natural history of the organism and how to mimic that aquarium so that you're producing those natural behaviors that you would see in the wild.
And. Similar to like a lobster, you can't really put anything else on the tank with a cuttlefish, right? Because they're gonna eat them.
Yeah, weirdly enough, I'm seeing some places that are putting some. I've seen Bangai cardinal fish in with cuttlefish, and probably, you know, eat the fish. From my perspective, the bigger issue would be if they don't eat their tank mates. Pretty quickly, they don't see the tank mates as prey anymore. And the tank mates might actually see the cuttlefish as prey. Hmm. And, you know, my cephalopod bias is you don't need other tank mates in with cuttlefish or octopus. They're, you know, awesome enough on their own.
I mean, what would be your advice to somebody that wanted to start a cuttlefish tank?
You got to have enough live food. You know, again, I know folks have tried things like amphipods and brine shrimp to, you know, feed hatchling cuttlefish. But, you know, if you don't feed them to satiation multiple times a day, satiation just until they stop eating, then they're not going to grow normally, and they're going to have stunted growth. And so you're not going to see that, you know, real, you know, quote unquote, big cuttlefish that you'd want to see because they didn't have enough food at that critical life stage when they're growing up. So as we're preparing to, you know, try to culture these cuttlefish, first, we're really preparing to try to culture their food, which is live mice eating grass shrimp. And we have students, you know, just dedicated on getting that going, because until we get that going, we can't guarantee we have enough food, because ordering it in every week is quite expensive for us.
Yeah, live seafood. I could see how that could that could add up, especially when you're in Iowa, so it's not necessarily right at your doorstep. The Stingray Gulf of Mexico tank. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, this tank is a great example of what our program is all about, because around COVID, we got rid of most of our elasmobranchs because we just couldn't deal with it. We couldn't support them. We didn't have enough students. And at the beginning of this year, a student came to me and said she wanted stingrays and sharks. And I said, well, no, here's why. Now, if you want to, you know, write up a proposal of why we can get them again, you know, everything about it, go ahead. She came back a month later with a written proposal of A, B, C, D. I worked with some colleagues and some friends, and we had two stingrays donated to us from an aquarium in the Midwest, and been with us for now, I guess, 4 months or so. And so we've turned that tank into a mixed species tank. We have stingrays, and we have four or five different species of Gulf or, you know, Caribbean fishes in there. We also have some mangroves grown in there to kind of show that. And it was just a neat example. You know, I told her my feelings on why we don't have stingrays, and she took it and made it happen. And it's just really cool to see that progress. But it was, you know, months and months of work on her part.
I mean, it almost sounds like a, you know, an accelerated high school program for college. I mean, it was like, you know what I mean? It's like a low-level college type of program that you guys have there, in terms of really giving the students hands-on experience.
Yeah, and the students get, or they receive college credit in the course, too.
Oh, they do.
So, you know, they take the marine biology course, they can get eight college credits. Wow. They take aquarium science, they can get six. And so they're quote unquote playing with fish, learning cool things, getting college credit at the same time. I mean, it's not always a win-win every day, but in the long run, it's certainly a win-win.
Aquaballs, nice screen name, asks how many years does it take to be a marine biologist? So what are you looking at there, Greg, if you want to become a marine biologist? Typically.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of depends. You know, I tell my students, if you kind of want to just go and help and, you know, help others do their projects, you know, you can go get your undergrad in 3 to 4 years and you're kind of helping them. If you, you know, want to do some work for the government and kind of do government projects, you probably have to get a master's. So that's, you know, 2 to 4 more years. If you want to ask your own questions and kind of lead others on expeditions like I do, you got to get your PhD. And so I went to school for a total of 9 years, which I don't think is too bad, to get my undergrad, my master's, and my PhD.
Yeah.
And but there's so many ways to do it. I mean, that's the other thing that I impress upon my students is, you know, a lot of them want to go to Florida for marine biology, which is great, you know, great place. But there's so many other directions you can take to get to where you want to be. It doesn't have to just be Florida or bust.
Yeah. Or even internationally, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I mentioned one of my students is getting their PhD and he's in Australia right now. And that was just his path. He was my student my very first year. And he actually came back this year to talk to my current students and tell them what he's doing now, how he got there, and kind of, you know, inspire them in that direction as well.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Let's take a few look at a few more of the tanks here, and then we'll get into to some other stuff. I said to you that this looks to me like a big colony of clove polyps. If anybody in the viewing audience wants to correct me, but it looks like I'm not exactly sure. I guess you said you're not a coral guy, so
yeah. My colleague Kirk Embry's our coral guy. I make him mad when I say they're just like pretty colorful rocks to me.
That's not an anemone, is it? I mean, it's a big. I can't tell. It is beautiful though. I love the way it just fits in naturally there. And then you've got this what I call like a square blue tank, and I think it said I can't see it. It's too small on my screen right now, but it's got the hippo tang, the emperor angel, I believe, in there.
Yeah, that's our Nautilus tank for future Nautilus, but right now it's serving as our mooring buoy exhibit to highlight mooring buoys and what their function is in the wild to, you know, prevent boats from anchoring. So if folks can see, there's like a little chain that's going up to a buoy.
Yeah.
And again, a talking point so we can talk about it, look at it in the classroom, but talk about how that applies to conserving things in the wild.
Cool. Great Beard of Reef, Paul says, I take Australia over Florida any day.
I agree.
Me too, although I've never been to Australia. I'd like to go to Australia. Ben, I think this is is this a sea robin tank?
Yeah, that's one of our Gulf of Mexico tanks. And at the top, I think there's probably some artificial sargassum. But just to kind of show, well, for one, a really unique species of sea robin that have those pelvic fins that are modified to kind of, you know, feel along the bottom, but to really highlight that Gulf ecosystem, which again, I think just gets overshadowed by all the, you know, the coolness of the coral reef and such.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love the variety, Greg, in terms of all the different types of tanks and animals that you have. It's not just one thing. It's a really big, wide variety in terms of the types of tanks and the animals in those tanks. So that's just awesome. And then the Bangai cardinal fish, are you guys breeding them?
So the aquarium science students are trying to breed them. And we are hoping that we set up a good ecosystem in this tank where they'll just do it on their own. We have about 10 or 15 in that particular tank. And we also have some garden eels in that system as well. So, you know, trying to highlight some species that, you know, can coexist together. And again, Bangai cardinal fish has such a unique history of, you know, numbers in the wild and hugely successful aquaculture in different places. And so we're trying to set up the right place for it to happen. Hasn't happened yet. I think they're a little young for now.
What kind of animals do you not have that you would like to have at the lab?
That's a great great question. For me, it always goes back to invertebrates. I really like I want animals that tell a story. And so crown of thorn starfish to me, just tell a unique story of their impact on coral reef ecosystems, you know, throughout the Pacific. And they're such an engaging display animal because they just look scary. I mean, they're colorful, they can get large. Crown of thorn starfish is one animal that I wish we had in the lab. And some of just these really unique snails that, you know, burrow under sand and are inhabiting a very different role than some of our other fishes that we think about. Fishes, I leave that up to my students. You know, they kind of have a say in what we bring in. The inverts are where I kind of, my focus goes, just because, again, I think they kind of get overshadowed by some of these other organisms.
So do you guys have a budget in terms of being able to bring in animals? Do you take donations? Because I know one of my viewers, Michael Bazzi, is asking if there is a way for viewers like him to financially support your program.
There certainly is. I mean, we are a public school. You know, we have a pretty strong budget that supports our day-to-day stuff throughout the year, you know, like salt, food, you know, changing pumps. And really, we wouldn't be able to provide as many opportunities as we do without donations from, you know, organizations, people, zoos and aquariums. I know Polo Reef is one of the sponsors tonight. They've helped us out. And I think that's the cool thing, because then, you know, the students see that, yes, we're landlocked, we're in Des Moines in the Midwest, but our tentacles like extend out, and everyone just wants to support these students and just give them the best. And that's another just cool thing about our program, is all the folks around the country and the world who want to help. That's really neat.
So if they wanted to do that, Greg, is there a specific place that they can go to on the web to help financially support what's going on there?
Yeah, they can go to dmschools.org. That's our school district. And you could probably just search Central Campus Marine Biology, Des Moines, Iowa. You type in my name and you'll find my email. It's, you know, a public email since it's for the school, and should be able to reach me there. We're also on, you know, Instagram, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, we welcome any support just to be able to keep doing what we're doing.
Very cool. You got another Sephead in the audience. You got Rich Ross. What's happening there, Rich? The comment is, Greg, quadruple exclamation point.
Sounds like Rich. Thanks, Rich.
So you guys have traded some research, or you guys how do you know one another?
I've known Rich for might be going on 20 years now. Wow. Through the Tonmo website, the Octopus News magazine online, and just talking about cephalopod husbandry, cuttlefish, squid, octopus, and known him for a while.
Very cool. I didn't realize being a CEP head was a thing.
I don't think anybody did till Rich. So
he started that whole thing. So, okay, you led an expedition of 40 students to the East Coast earlier this year, and so your students were engaged. I'm just digesting this, in 9 days of intensive learning. Can you talk about that expedition? Like, where did you guys go, and what kind of learning did you do there?
Yeah, so every year we do a similar trip, just to a different coastal destination. And this year we decided to go to New York and Boston. And the goal of the course is to, you know, it's certainly not a vacation. You know, I tell the students we're not going there to hang out on the beach.
No sightseeing?
We do a little sightseeing, but usually it's because we're on our way rushing from one aquarium to another. And it's to give them opportunities to talk with professionals in the field, to ask questions, to give business cards out to network, and just do it all to see how far you can push yourself. Mm. We wake up every day at 5:30 or 6, and we usually do yoga or we do a beach run.
Wow.
And yeah.
Wake up the brain there, huh?
Yep. Yeah. Get outside, you know, let's get going. And, you know, I think on this trip, we went to 9 different aquariums around the East Coast. We went to research facilities from like Harvard and Columbia University, where I have some colleagues that invited us in. We do some cultural things and historical things, like going to Boston and walking the Freedom Trail. And it's to kind of connect students with the science of aquariums and marine biology, but also with the local folks and the different cultures that might be there, the different history that might be there. But again, you know, as a, much of a stickler as I am with algae on a tank, like, I need students to really be engaged. And it's hard because most of them haven't been up for, you know, 14-hour days, 7 days in a row, so they get tired. But they're taking notes. They have field books. This trip was one of the best, just because of the way they presented Central Campus and to me, you know, all of Des Moines and Iowa to folks all across the Eastern Seaboard. It was impressive what they were able to do, and it's just to give them an opportunity to do something different. See if they really want to go into the marine sciences, and if they do, you know, they have those contacts with folks at aquariums, folks at universities, whatever it may be, so that they know people now.
Networking at an early age. I love it. I love it.
It's hard. It's hard to network.
It is. It really is. You got to really put yourself out there.
Yeah. It still makes me uncomfortable when I go to conferences. It's just, I'm never going to get comfortable with it, but I still do it.
I hear you, man. What were your impressions of Andrew Sandler's Polo Reef? What was your impressions, and then the students' impressions?
Well, first, my impressions were just how just welcoming he was to these 40 kids just coming in, wanted to see this awesome tank, and just the amount of everything that he has there, like, so perfect, was just awesome for the students to see. And for me, I can kind of just sit back and I have to compose myself a little bit, not get myself excited, but just to see the students going up to the tank and, like, you know, naming the fish, and for me, using their scientific names, I really appreciated that because we're big on scientific names. And again, just asking questions, you know, it was questions like, why do you do this? It wasn't like, they were advanced questions, and it was just cool, really cool to see. The students gave Andrew a talk as well, kind of shared our program with him. And, you know, he was asking the same questions back at them. You know, why are y'all doing this? have you thought of this? And, you know, throughout the tour, throughout that day, again, the students fully engaged. And, you know, sometimes when Andrew's dogs jumped up on their lap and they were engaged in the petting for a little bit, and then engaged in the cool feeding that went on, engaged in the behind the scenes stuff, but just super engaged in the moment and not taking it for granted. There were no cell phones out. I mean, they were taking pictures, but like nobody was just, you know, on their phone. And it, just awesome, awesome to see.
A highly engaged audience, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys also visited the Long Island Aquarium. I've never been to the Long Island Aquarium. I wanted to go, and it didn't sync up the last time I was on Long Island. But thoughts on the Long Island Aquarium? That's got a hell of a reef tank in it.
Yeah, and just to see the comparison, you know, from both reef tanks, because we went, you know, to the Long Island Aquarium right after, and again, you know, now that's one reef tank, and then folks there caring for other organisms, and Joe Iulo there, you know, toured us around. We were kind of short on time because I always try and cram in so much stuff. But again, he was answering questions. One of our students is really into LSS, life support systems, and he wants to do that.
What's a life support system?
So like the kind of the behind the scenes folks of, you know, really making the pumps run, fixing the pumps, doing all the stuff that, you know, aquarists maybe don't do at a lot of facilities. And, you know, Joe made it happen to have the student talk with one of their folks about pumps, about, you know, different filtration units. How do you do all this on a larger scale? And, you know, just to be able to see the Long Island Aquarium, the reef tank now, I think last time I was there was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And I know there's been some changes, but you feel like you're in the ocean. It's just incredible that all that stuff is alive. It still weirds me out.
Pretty cool. So what would you say were like the three biggest takeaways from your students on that trip? I'm sure you got, you know, back to Iowa with them, or maybe on the trip itself, and kind of talked about, you know, some of the things along the way that you had seen. But in terms of the kind of the feedback that you were hearing, what do you think they got out of the trip, the biggest things they got out of the trip?
I think one of them was being able to learn how to push themselves and learn how far they can actually push themselves. I know sometimes that I'll push them a little too far and I need to pull back, because I just really want them to see like what is their true potential, like what can they really, really accomplish. I think another thing was being able to accomplish certain things in a team, whether it's, you know, weird things trying to diagnose what's going on in this tank, or, you know, just some kind of team building activity in the rain when we're in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, talking about Rachel Carson and her impact on women in science and things like that. And I think the other thing I remember hearing from students was just everyone that we spoke to was so excited to speak with them. And so they saw people that, you know, nobody was just giving us their spiel. I mean, they were real people, whether they're at, you know, a tour guide in Boston, you know, a professor at Harvard, Andrew, Joe. I mean, they were talking to them like they're people. And so I think it gave them hopefully a way to see, like, when you move on to your next career and you're, you know, a little afraid of talking to that big person in the industry, like, we're all just people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ask questions, they'll ask questions to you, and, you know, you'll get through it.
All right, a couple of questions from John Wright, who is tuning in from England. So it's in the wee hours of the morning in England there. First question that John wants to know is, does Greg share thoughts with other marine biologists worldwide?
Yes, if I understand the question correctly. So even with this program, you know, I work with colleagues around the country, and then, you know, I also have colleagues around the world who, you know, help with the program, but then also help with my kind of outside research with Save the Nautilus of doing field research throughout the Pacific. So, you know, I have colleagues in lots of different countries. At this point, I'd probably say most countries around the world, which is, again, a cool connection to bring back to the students here in Des Moines of, you know, having somebody from, you know, Morocco Skype in with these students and talk about marine science or something
really
different.
Cool. And the other question is, this was a kind of a topic we were talking about before in terms of the students really being hands-on, but John's wondering what you do when things go wrong with pumps and, you know, when things go wrong, like pumps going down and all that sort of thing. So, you know, what we're talking about before is that pretty much the students are the ones that are dealing with all the these types of things. And I guess you're just kind of stepping in if they hit a wall.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, you know, in the case of a pump going down, let's first, you know, diagnose, you know, what do water levels mean in a sump and an aquarium, you know, when they're too high, too low. And, but again, the thing that kind of sucks is we're stuck into this 90 minutes of a class time. So, you know, unfortunately we can't train everybody on how to change a pump. We have some lab assistants that are in the course for up to 3 years total. And, you know, sometimes it's really handy to be able to lean on them and say, you know, hey, you're a 17-year-old kid. Can you please go change that pump? And they know how to do it for the most part. There's always going to be, you know, an issue of not opening up a valve and then having water kind of on the floor. But again, it's that learning process. And, you know, somewhat related, we do hit those low moments throughout the school year where they're not bringing it. I mean, it's like I'm big into sports. It's like for whatever reason, the whole team is just, we're not there. And so, you know, there are times I'm a very kind of symbolic guy. I lock the lab and we just do classroom stuff because I need them to know, like, it's not necessarily a right, you know, to care for these organisms. It's a privilege. They're living things that we're taking out of the ocean. You know, we need to be with it every day. And when we're not there every day, like say something, like say, hey, I got to take a break. I got stuff going on in my life. I can't focus. So it's not all, you know, glory. There are the rough days. We just try to eliminate as many rough days as possible.
Some lessons to be learned there. So this is incredible. 9 of your students recently earned a special designation, an opportunity to be by becoming NOAA Ocean Guardian Youth Ambassadors. Wow. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for the United States, and you know they oversee lots of different things. But this opportunity was sent to me in fall from a colleague at the school, and you know again I want my students to try, and so I required all of my students to apply for this program. Mm. You know, thinking none would get in, and you know I've heard one got in, two got in. 3, 4, 5, and then 9 total were accepted into this countrywide program. And, you know, weirdly enough, and I guess the program is to train the leaders of tomorrow in the marine sciences. And weirdly enough, from a colleague to a colleague to a colleague, I got connected with the folks running that program, and they were like, what's going on with Iowa? Like, why do we have, you know, 100 students applying for this? And because there were so... we were so unique and they wanted to try something, they actually invited all of my students to be part of this program. It's like a classroom pilot project where students have to watch a webinar every month and they, you know, have homework to do outside of class. And it's all part of a bigger kind of connection to see how they can, you know, ask questions and become involved with, you know, solutions for some of the issues facing our oceans. And 9 students, it was very, very cool to see. The school was so happy, the district was so happy, and the students were so happy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what was the reaction of the students in terms of what they got out of the program?
Yeah, well, they're still in it. It goes till December 2024, and they're asking questions, which I think is cool. They're not just kind of regurgitating, you know, what they might see in the media or on social media. They're asking lots of questions, which is kind of hard to answer. But they're, you know, they're engaging with peers across the country, which again I think is very, very cool that they can be a part of.
So we talked about before in terms of whether or not you collaborate with other marine biologists worldwide. This is also just pretty incredible. You have been chosen to participate in an international effort. You were selected by the United Nations as part of a pool of experts for the regular process for global reporting and assessment of the state of the marine environment. Wow, man, what's that all about? I'm just kind of like blown away in terms of you know, all these amazing accolades and opportunities that you and your students are you're getting, and the attention worldwide that you're getting. It's just amazing, Greg.
Yeah, and you said that very good. I think I still can't say that full, you know, United Nations thing. it's certainly not easy, but, you know, one of the reasons I came to Des Moines to run the marine biology program was because I could still continue my own research efforts and what I wanted to do professionally. And so as these things come up, like working with the United Nations, where we're trying to assess cephalopod populations kind of around the world and how that impacts socioeconomics of communities. And so this truly is a worldwide team of folks from the United States, Europe, Asia, Africa, all over, trying to get this kind of assessment together. And, you know, to talk to my students about what that means, and just kind of some of these behind the scenes organizations, and also maybe a lot of behind the scenes work that scientists do that, you know, we don't necessarily get paid for, because we, you know, I love doing this. I mean, I want to do it. But just to give them that other aspect of, you know, if you want to go into a career, get your PhD, become a scientist, you know, you're probably going to have to make just some decisions on how much you're going to do to not get paid for, if that makes sense, how much you want to volunteer your own time to do some things. And sometimes I say no. You know, it's the hardest thing I ever learned, was saying no to certain things. But, you know it's right. You get it done. You might be up late for 2 a.m. sometimes, writing very late. Some nights, you know, maybe I'm in bed by 9 p.m. like I like. So this whole United Nations process kind of just started, but it's just another way that I can talk to my students about what's going on right now in marine sciences and marine biology that I'm doing. And again, they were excited about it too. It was cool to see them kind of happy for me, which is also nice at those late 2 a.m. nights.
What are some of the specifics that are going on right now with that research?
So right now it's like compiling data and compiling papers. And my focus specifically is working on nautiluses. That's my main focus right now. There's other folks working on squid populations, octopus, cuttlefish, and, you know, eventually we'll come together. We will update the most recent assessment, put in any new data, any new papers, and publish that and push that forward.
All right. Switching gears again to something that's pretty awesome. You have an affiliation as a research scientist with the American Museum of Natural History. What's all that about, Greg?
Yeah, it's all about Nautilus too. This
you are the Nautilus expert here, right?
Yeah, I'm one of a few. Fortunately, when not too many people study them, like, you're all kind of experts. So, I've been studying Nautilus for almost 20 years now, and weirdly enough, I started to work with paleontologists, and to me, the way that a paleontologist mind works is just like mind-boggling. To, you know, be able to think about what 400 million years ago looked like, and, you know, they can actually see that in their brain. And they're interested in Nautilus because it's one of the last living relatives of the fossilized Nautiloids and ammonites. And, you know, so fortunately I got to know lots of paleontologists. One of them, Dr. Neil Landman, is at the American Museum of Natural History. And, you know, over time and our work together, I ended up getting this position here, this affiliation, I should say. And it's just one of those things to, again, share with students. What it means is I have resources with the American Museum of Natural History that I wouldn't have otherwise. But again, it's one of those things that isn't necessarily paid, and kind of talking to them about what that an affiliation means versus a kind of position, and just trying to let them know about that.
Talk to us about the United States Endangered Species Act and the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. You're also part of that.
Yeah, again, it's something that I think a lot of folks have probably heard about, the Endangered Species Act in the United States, but this other thing, the CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, is a little less known. And both kind of want to protect and save organisms in different ways. And when we were doing field Nautilus research, you know, again, you know, it's not just collecting the information, like what happens once you know populations are declining. And so now, I guess this would have been 2016, Our Save the Nautilus team worked with folks in the United States and ended up getting one species of Nautilus listed under this Endangered Species Act as a threatened species. And what that means is hopefully more awareness, hopefully a little more kind of help from folks to know that, yeah, we kind of need to keep an eye on this. And the CITES group is an international group where 182 countries now agree that, you know, whatever we put on this list, we as 182 countries, we will protect, we'll enforce regulations and blah, blah, blah. And 2017, all Nautiluses were listed under this Appendix 2 listing, which means that you can't trade them between countries without a permitting system, which makes sense. I mean, we didn't necessarily want to shut down trade. We just wanted to keep track of it a little better. Now, the unfortunate side for me, because I do a lot of work with public aquariums, I'm involved with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, that listing kind of closed the aquarium trade for Nautiluses, for public aquariums or hobbyists, for better or worse. And so now we're trying to kind of work through that to see how we can get Nautiluses back in the public's mind and get them in public aquariums, because the conservation message of an animal disappearing that's been around for 500 million years is just too much to, you know, not get in folks' faces. So, but again, to talk about the students, talk with the students of what does it take to get something listed on the Endangered Species Act? Mm. It's a lot of work. What does it take to get something on CITES? I mean, it's papers and writing. I mean, it's, you know, having hard discussions with your colleagues. It takes a lot to get it done, and just to show them that behind the scenes stuff.
Really, it's just incredible in terms of the real world experience that they're seeing.
I think they know it too.
So how connected are you and your students to the reef keeping hobby? I mean, the majority of my viewers are reef keepers, and you know, so I think it's incredible that what you guys are doing there in terms of the youth that is being injected into the you know, marine biology, aquarium science world. But you know, I think also in terms of reef keeping, you know, perhaps some of these students will tend to their own aquarium or reef tank once they're out of the program, or maybe they're already you know, running their own tanks. But so I guess, in terms of you and your students, how in touch are they with reef keepers in terms of the hobby of it?
Yeah, I think we're probably scratching the surface of how in touch we probably should be. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I was glad to come on here. It's something that, you know, as we're trying to build our social media and, you know, trying to share what we're doing, it's a whole different landscape of knowledge and ideas, which, you know, I really want our students to know about and connect with. We did take students to MACNA a few years ago, which was one of, it was in Milwaukee.
Yep.
So it was kind of a,
I was at that one.
Oh, awesome.
That was the only MACNA I've ever been to.
Oh, I think that was my second, maybe. So we're trying, and because, you know, I want students to, you know, not come out of our program with, maybe not, but maybe come out with a fish tank. I mean, there's so much learning that happens with that, and just, you know, knowledge in the reef keeping community that maybe we haven't found the best way to connect. And I don't know. So if there are folks here, hopefully, you know, I can connect with folks that are listening today and kind of help me, you know, better kind of show what our students are doing and connect with y'all, whether it's through a reef tank they have at home or, you know, the reef tank they're caring for in the lab and they want to talk about. It's just a kind of a blind side to me right now.
It's pretty incredible in terms of what's going on in the hobby right now. There's a lot of things that have changed. There's a lot more data. It's a lot more data driven. A lot of times that can get us hobbyists into trouble because we have too much information and we're acting on that information more so than we should be. I guess I'm speaking, you know, more so for myself, but there's a tendency for that to happen. I think in terms of the modern reef keeper.
I think there's a tendency for that to happen to anyone. I mean, I think sometimes we want to collect so much data, but then, yeah, that pendulum swings like too far the other direction. And we're like, we kind of either act too much or we're like stuck in inaction. And so, you know, it's another reason why I really like the The Tonmo community, it's more, you know, cephalopod based, but it connects, you know, scientists, hobbyists, and everything in between for like that common good. And because we all have something to share, we all have something we can provide to each other and learn from.
Yeah, I mean, there is some pretty cool stuff going on. There's, you know, coral spawning is going on. Jamie Craggs is, doing a lot of research on that, and even hobbyists are trying to spawn corals. Have you been kind of keeping on the periphery of all that stuff?
Yeah, I definitely follow what he's doing out there, and because I mean, I don't know how he does it. I mean, he's awesome at what he does. Hugely successful person. And again, just trying to show that students, like, I want to break down science for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think too far we think of a scientist as, you know, somebody who they aren't. I mean, and just kind of people like Dr. Jamie Craggs and people like other folks that are doing stuff in different ways, you know, are kind of becoming scientists. I mean, if you have a reef tank, you're really a scientist. I mean, you have to be. You're asking questions, you're making changes, you're analyzing the results, and you're doing something different. It's kind of a different type of science. And again, I grew up hating science, I hated science. And so that's kind of my perspective of just, I don't want my students to hate science. I want them to think about it kind of in a very unique way and hopefully a fun way. So I'm hoping we're going to be more and more connected with the reef keeping community and just kind of learn from y'all and again, highlight what our students are doing here.
Yeah, even in terms of determining, you know, whether or not there's, you know, coral pathogens present in reef tanks that are causing coral disease, you know, there's been a lot of experimentation by hobbyists using antibiotics. But there's also been some, you know, scientific research behind it to help put more clarity in terms of that sort of thing, in terms of treating a tank to rid it of coral diseases and things like that.
Right, and I think that's the important connection too. And one of the things we see, you know, maybe not in reef keeping, but when we visit like public aquariums, you know, I think aquarists also get kind of a for whatever reason, they're not considered like scientists or something because they don't publish papers. You know, usually they're very busy doing what they're doing and they have a problem. They got to get to a solution. Yes, they have some background knowledge they're using and they may not just publish afterwards, but they are doing some cool stuff. And, you know, just breaking down those barriers of what we really think science is all about.
I'm curious, do you guys utilize any antibiotics in your tanks, or is that something you don't really believe in putting in every tank?
We use it if we need to. We do some prophylactics for fishes when they come in, when, you know, we're getting them through the quarantine stage. And fortunately, we have some really nice vets, Dr. Robert Martinez and Dr. Starling, that volunteer their time to, you know, if we have a sick fish, then, you know, we can take some photos or videos, send it to them, and they can say, hey, you know, try this, try that. And so, you know, when we do get to those points, we will use antibiotics, or if we have, you know, parasite outbreaks, we use different medications for those depending on the parasite.
There's a lot going on, right? I mean, there's just so many different, you know, organisms that sometimes it's kind of hard to tell what's good and what's bad. It's a very complex thing when you're dealing with a little ecosystem like that.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's what the students see is just so, it's more complex than just a tank. I mean, you have this going on, you have this going on, and they're kind of always amazed when, you know, I tell them we most likely have parasites in all of our tanks. I mean, we're probably never going to get rid of them. We just hopefully can reduce the stressors in place to, you know, have them pop up and cause an issue. But I mean, you just got to learn through trial and error and maybe some more trial and error to figure out the best practices for your own individual tank too, right? That's the thing that kind of sucks, because every tank is a little different too. I mean, every ecosystem in the wild is a little different. Mm-hmm. So you got to consider your own personal things as well.
Well, there's a saying in the reef tank hobby world, it's always something. It's always something that's going on that you got to deal with. It's never,
it's like, think that's teaching industry too. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So Greg, what are your hopes in terms of the future of the program there in Iowa? Any visions beyond what is currently going on?
I mean, our next big kind of goal that I mentioned is breeding cuttlefish and octopus, but beyond that, I'm hoping like the next couple of years are kind of a pause in our renovations. We've been changing out some tanks recently. We're updating all of our sumps, and progress with high school students is great, but it is so slow. Yeah. Just because it has to be. So once we can kind of get all this stuff renovated, then I really want to get our program back to asking those questions and having students publish papers, whether it's in a reef magazine or whether it's online somewhere or a scientific paper. That's kind of what we did my first couple of years. And we've gotten away from that because we wanted to make some updates. We wanted to add some water quality monitoring equipment. We wanted to tear down 10 tanks, add a big tank. So I'm excited to stop building and rebuilding. And for me, kind of get back to basics and give students chances just to ask questions in our lab, as opposed to, you know, plumb protein skimmers on and do all that.
Well, Greg, this has just been an incredible, learning experience for me in terms of understanding what you folks are doing out in Iowa. Any advice to people out there that are just so intrigued by this kind of program in terms of potentially trying to start a program like this at their local, high school?
Yes. First, certainly reach out to me. We're trying to build this connection of high schools that maybe don't have a facility like ours, but have something so that we have folks who can answer those questions of how do you deal with an aquarium and a high school student. But there are things to consider. You know, you gotta what do you do on weekends? I mean, I know a lot of friends and teachers that they go in and feed on the weekends. They do that. I think start off with freshwater. I just think it's, you reduce your variables and you learn. You know, it's not for the students, it's for you to learn how to do that. And, find a way to make it happen. You know, we are fortunate to be able to, help out places with, different donations of stuff that we have in the lab that we frag. So, we can do that. But reach out to me and just kind of try. And you're never going to know if it works if you don't try.
Yeah, people watching out there or listening, if you're listening to the podcast, we need more fish tanks, more aquariums in high schools and elementary schools, middle schools, whatever kind of school, because it's the future of the hobby. It's the future, for a lot of young folks out there that have this kind of interest. And I think the more that they could have hands-on experience and just kind of get them really jazzed about this sort of stuff. Like we talked earlier on in the show, it's a great real world learning experience. Whether or not you're going to end up in the field of marine biology or aquarium science, it's just it's going to teach kids a lot, and kids are the future, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're just going to learn more about the tank when they do that. They're going to learn more about the ecosystem, the planet, and just be more ready to deal with the future.
All right, Greg. Well, listen, man, I really appreciate you taking the time. We made it through with the Skype. It turned out to somehow self-correct itself, your Wi-Fi there. So I'm totally psyched about that. We had a smooth little live stream here. And again, I appreciate your willingness to come on. And good for you and for all the students out there that are participating, have participated. I commend you. And great stuff, man. Really great stuff.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate you having me on. And hopefully someone out there heard something very cool from this. Thank you.
Yeah. And like Greg said, if you want to donate money, or if you want more information in terms of how to do this sort of thing in your town, then you could reach out to him through the Des Moines school's website. What's the web address for the school, Greg? Is it a simple web address, or should they?
It's pretty simple. dmschools.org.
dmschools.org. Pretty simple. All right. Well, listen, Greg, I thank you again for being on the live stream. I also want to thank my sponsors one more time, Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through the website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Todd might even have some more Reef Bum stickers, so if you mention Reef Bum and he's got some stickers, he might throw one in your box there of stuff that you ordered. Polo Reef. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday in the new Polo podcast with Mike Sensky. We dive into the world of professional custom aquarium design and the story behind the journey. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. And finally, Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums. From macro elements to trace elements and pollutants, you get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. I am now a certified Fauna Marine ICP test advisor, so if you want help interpreting results, then select me. All right. Big thank you to Paul, who's also the moderator, as well as the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. Also want to let you know that all episodes of Wrapping the Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next Wrapping the Reef Bum live stream will be next Tuesday, May 28th, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I've got Dong Zhou back on the show from Acro Garden. That's always a great time with Dong, so don't miss that one next week. You can check out the full upcoming schedule of guests on reefbum.com under the YouTube section. Until next time, be safe and be well.